You're listening to Split Reel, the Chicago Independent Radio Project show on popular culture and societal attitudes. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and I'll be examining how film, television, and other elements of mass media both shape and reflect how we think about the world. For more information or archive shows, visit kevinfulham.net. Welcome to another edition of Split Reel for Chirp Radio here in Chicago. My name is Kevin Fulham, and today we'll be talking about today's mediated population. We're a culture that now goes to great lengths to dissect mass media, which leads to the question of whether we're much more sophisticated about culture than we have been in generations past, however you define that term. My guest is cultural critic Leonard Pierce, who is a contributor to numerous publications. He's also the author of If You Like the Sopranos. It's a recent book on the history of crime, cinema, and television. Welcome to the show, Leonard.
Thank you. It's good to be back. It's been a while.
Leonard also has a website at ludickid.com. That's ludickid.com. And what else have you been working on, Leonard?
Well, I've been working on a lot of projects, but I just recently released my second book, which is called Moots from Marbletown. And it can be got through my website, which, by the way, the Ludickid website is still functional, but even easier, you can now just go to leonardpierce.com. It's leonardpierce.com. And on the front page, if you click where it says books, you can buy both of my books and you can find out what else I've been working on.
So Leonard, you know, we've been doing shows actually for a number of years, probably I think almost 10 years now. And if you look at how the nature of cultural criticism has evolved, it's crazy. You know, I remember the finale of The Sopranos came out and you had article after article after article on the web dissecting the last 10-minute sequence with Tony in the diner. And it just seems that the whole notion of mass media criticism has just ballooned exponentially every year. Which leads to the question, what does that mean as far as, I don't know if you want to call it cultural sophistication, cultural knowledge, you know, in terms of how we interpret film? Are we more sophisticated today than we've been in the past? What are we talking about with regards to, say, the mediated culture?
That's a thorny question because, you know, we can be talking about both the technology of mediation, in which case we are infinitely more sophisticated than we used to be, you know, just in terms of having the internet, of having access to media through computers, through telephones, through gadgetry, you know, that communication has become instant and content has become universal. You know, there's almost no way to not see something if you want to see it now. So in that sense, we're much more mediated than we used to be. But there's also a sense of cultural mediation, which I think is on the decline, insofar as we're able to take in much more culture than we used to be able to. But in practical terms, we're taking in only a tiny portion of what there is to see and to hear and to experience. The enormous access we have to media has not really changed our taste that much. It's actually focused them in a very laser-like way. So you have 50 million, 100 million people all taking place in a conversation about media, but most of them are talking about the same things. You know, they're talking about the same films and the same music and the same books. You know, it's the promise of the internet, you know, and of mass communications in that regard of a mediated society has had, obviously, its ups and downs, its good points and its bad points. And good points are, you know, that we can expose ourselves to culture we couldn't even dream of accessing before. There's almost no such thing as a lost record or a lost film anymore. But on the downside, our tastes have become a lot more chelated. You know, our tastes are a lot more set in stone than we used to. People are not really taking advantage of that, of the media access we have to broaden their horizons as much as you might think.
Why do you think that's the case? Or how do you see evidence of that?
I think partly it's the fact that along with consumers in new media, producers have become very adept at new media as well. So you have marketing that is targeted in an extreme way. You know, the people who make movies like The Avengers or, you know, whatever the week's blockbuster is, are just as adept at directing our focus through mass media and new media onto their product as people are to find culture and talk about it. So the Garden of Eden has been corrupted by the snake, if you want to take that attitude, you know, that the the people who produce culture are using new technology to sell it, as well as people are using it to consume it. But also, you know, in all media, there's always been a sort of herd mentality. You know, people like to talk about the things that everyone else is talking about. And, you know, it's also, as free as the internet can be at times, media is still very much driven by profit. So it's a lot profitable to have 1,000 websites all talking about Mad Men than having those same 1,000 websites all talking about some old movie or TV show or record or something that nobody's ever heard of. And you can argue that it would be better for us critically and culturally if we were all talking about relatively undiscovered things. But as far as people who pay the bills are concerned, they want us all talking about the same things, you know, because that's what brings in the readers.
It's funny, you mentioned sort of the laser-like focus of marketing. You know, if you have Netflix accounts, you know, you turn to the main page and they have recommendations if you like dark, suspenseful movies. Right, you have websites. I don't know if it's Spotify or, you know, you plug in music that you like and it'll automatically churn out more of that kind of music. Just focusing on exactly what it is that you have a taste for and giving you more of that.
Right, that's true in a certain sense, but in another sense, they're only giving you things that they own. So,
sure.
Like, you're not going to dial into Netflix and have it recommend something. You know, even if it recommends stuff based on your tastes, it's going to try and steer you towards the more profitable stuff. You know, the first thing that you see when you pull up the Netflix queue right now is an ad for something that Netflix has created. You know, now that they've gotten into the business of providing content as well as streaming it. And, you know, Spotify is going to try and steer you towards things that are, you know, I mean, they'll obviously cater to your needs because they're trying to bring you back to the service. But it's a deeper question of whether or not they're trying to introduce you to new music or whether they're just trying to get you listening to what they need you to listen to. And that's a very tough question. You know, it's a very tough question in terms of these paradigms and these metrics and things that guide your tastes. There's a little bit of genuine interest in getting you to see things that you want to see, but there's also marketing involved in it. It's a double-edged sword.
I want to talk about this sort of the definition of the word sophistication. How has this been defined in the past? You know, you think of what does it mean to be culturally sophisticated? It seems that in the past, it's sort of been defined as what the upper strata of society preferred. You know, that if you go back a couple hundred years and sophisticated people went to the opera, you know, as opposed to vaudeville. But how do you sort of see that word and that definition today?
That's an interesting question. It's something that I give a huge amount of thought to because there used to be a steel wall between what was, you know, termed high and low culture. There was high culture, which was created by educated people for educated people, was generally directed toward a particular type of religiously inspired or, or if it was secular, it had a certain highbrow quality to it. And it was the stuff that was taught in schools, and it was the what was called the canon. You know, these are the official great books and great composers and great artists of Western civilization. And then there was low culture, which was folk music and low art, you know, folk art and pulp fiction. And, you know, these definitions started to change around the time of modernism, you know, when literature became a lot more secularized, when you started to see a lot more quality work come from people in the lower classes and the non-educated classes. Sexual taboos started to fall, language taboos started to fall. And then when it really started to come apart was with the birth of rock and roll, which led a lot of people to question what exactly we meant by high and low culture in music. You know, in rock and roll's early days, you know, the guardians of culture all agreed that it was a low jungle form of music. And, you know, later as it got more sophisticated, to return to that word, people started to say, well, you know, what do we mean by that? You know, what's the difference between well-written rock and roll and a well-written classical music? What about jazz? You know, jazz comes from a sort of low culture background, but it has high culture qualities in terms of its professionalism and innovation and things like that. And, you know, I'm a postmodernist, so I believe the entire delineation between high and low culture is bogus. You know, it's an invention, and the more we bring it down, the better. But that also leads to a bit of a conundrum, which is on what basis then do we judge things to be quality or not? You know, if there's no objective standard between high and low culture, how can there be an objective standard between what is good art and what is bad art? And that's something that we're still struggling with.
Do you see a difference, though, also in terms of how we view high and low culture with regards to film versus and television versus music?
That's something that's shifting as well. Television, especially film, I think, has gotten to the point where it's a canonical art form. You know, there are film schools and there are people, you know, even the stodgiest critics will say that film is a medium capable of great art. Television, but until very recently, though, it was a bastard medium, you know, it was a great wasteland. And now that there's been a big movement towards making quality television, you know, I would say, you know, going back to The Sopranos, that was one of the shows that kicked off the movement towards real quality television. And now we see really great quality television all over the place. And people are starting to say, well, at what point do we admit television into the canon, you know? At what point do we say, well, this is a real art form now, and it's doing real quality work, and that distinction between high and low culture is alive in music. There's still a lot of people who don't consider pop music to be high culture, but I think that opinion is changing, and I think it's not going to be any time at all before television is, you know, just by the sheer weight of quality material going to be allowed into the canon, and people are going to say that it's a high culture thing, you know. And you see a reversal of that too. There's forms that I think are still considered high culture, but people don't really take them seriously anymore, like poetry. You know, poetry used to be one of the great callings for an artist. Many of the great names in the Western canon were poets, and now poetry has become sort of, you know, it's sort of become a niche. You know, I wouldn't say it's low culture, but it's sort of a niche art form now. It's not as, you know, modern forms of media have overtaken it, and theater I think is heading in that direction too. You know, that it's I hesitate to say that it's not relevant, but it's definitely not thought of in the same high culture category as it used to be before film became the dominant means of visual storytelling.
Well, sure, you don't have incredibly recognizable theater stars the way that you do for film stars, and going back to something like poetry, I mean, you can rattle off a whole list of quote-unquote famous poets or important poets if you want to go back to, you know, early half or mid-20th century, and then after a period of time, like, well, has there been any you know, famous poet to emerge over the last 20 years or 50 years, you know? And I, not that I follow the art form terribly closely, but, you know, nothing would come to mind.
That's something of a function of time, you know, and in 100 years, it'll probably be pretty clear who the great poets of the latter half of the 20th century were. But we don't pay as much attention to them as we used to, because we just don't care about poetry as much anymore. You know, it's it used to be a much more vital art form than it is now. And, you know, that's I'm not saying that as a judgment call. I'm just saying that, you know, people have stopped paying as much attention to poetry as they once did. And that's because of changing media climate.
Well, and also poetry has sort of been, you can say it's been encapsulated by music, right? I mean, it's, you know, if you set your lyrics to music and get them out there, you're going to reach a much, much wider audience that way.
Yeah, I suppose. I think of music and poetry as two different media, though, because, you know, it's become fashionable to say that music lyrics are poetry, but they're really not, because poetry has to stand on its own. And, you know, you can write pretty crappy lyrics and still have a great song if the music is good enough. So I think they're two different methods of expression. You know, it's they're comparable, but they occupy two different worlds as far as I'm concerned.
A minute ago, you were talking about this whole notion of television now being considered a serious art form, definitely over the last 10, 15 years or so. And so we talked before on shows about how, due to the nature of technology, you can produce much more complicated stories with things like DVD and access to, you know, shows on the internet. And the question is, so the fact that you have an audience that's hungry for this kind of television narrative storytelling, is it only a factor of technology? Or, you know, if you had something like The Sopranos or something like Homeland, and you put it back in the 1970s, and assuming you didn't have any issues with censors, would audiences back then, Do you think they would have responded the same way that they would have now?
I'm not sure, but you know, the ifs built into that are what make the argument. You know, assuming that you don't have any trouble with censors, well, of course you would. And that's one of the reasons that shows like that didn't get on the air. You know, the fact that we have less problems with censors today.
Okay, we'll step back for a minute. So HBO came into play 1980 or so, 1981.
Mm-hmm.
We'll put it in then and put it on cable back then. So again, you don't have any issues with censors putting it on cable television.
That's true, but you're talking about a what you're looking at now is a sort of a mass effect, you know, a deal where a lot of factors play at once that have led to a particular climate. And if you put it on the air back in 1980, first of all, it would have been difficult to do that because The Sopranos is a product of the development of a lot of sophisticated television shows. David Chase, who created The Sopranos, started out in the 1980s and 1990s at a time when a lot of really intelligent, creative people were getting into television. And we're now seeing the fruits of that labor, just as a lot of the people who worked on The Sopranos have gone on to create other good shows. So, who, you know, our theoretical person who put The Sopranos on in 1980 may not have been as good as the guy who put it on in 1999. Also, the reason that censorship climate is less intense today is because it had 20, 30 years to get that way. You know, in 1980, putting something like that on the air would have really shocked people and maybe alienated them because audiences might not have been ready for it. Nowadays, audiences are a lot more jaded. There are things that the FCC allows that they wouldn't allow before, just because they become normalized. So it's partly the talent that has come into play. It's partly that the climate has changed and that people are more, I don't know if I want to say sophisticated, because it doesn't necessarily make you sophisticated to, you know, to like violence or sex or cursing or whatever, but they're more inured to that sort of thing. They're used to it. It's not a shocking thing to them. They're more sophisticated in a very specific way. We've also had time to adapt to serial storytelling, which would have been a very new thing in 1980. Hardly anyone was doing it back then except soap operas. So, you know, it's just a variety of factors that have come into play that have allowed both audiences and producers to step a little farther every year than they did before.
So do you think that as time goes on, Hollywood has done a better job of portraying the quote-unquote real world compared to what's been produced in the past? There's less of a barrier maybe between the camera and what we might actually interpret as reality today versus something like 30 or 40 years ago. That's the question I have for you.
I would answer that question no. I think in certain terms, there is more realism in cinema in that people speak the way they speak. We don't have to conceal sexuality and violence. You know, we don't have to pretend these things aren't happening the way that we did in the days of the Hays Code. You know, we can portray certain aspects of life in a more realistic fashion. But has cinema done a good job of portraying realism in real life? No, they've done a terrible job of it. Americans hate realistic cinema. There's a huge tradition of it in Europe. And in America and Asia as well, but in America, we like escapism. You know, we like big action movies and genre films and, you know, explosions and aliens. And, you know, the things that dominate the box office are things that are the least realistic things imaginable. And, you know, a friend of mine, Tom Block, likes to say, you know, when he talks about Americans' love of escape film, he says, what are people escaping from anyway? We basically live in Disneyland, you know. Like, it's not like we have these miserable lives that we need, you know, to escape from them. But that's our taste, you know. And when you talk about realism in cinema, I think of stuff like Italian neorealism, you know, and like the movies of Ozu in Japan and stuff like that. You know, things that are about real people with real problems in their real lives, you know, where they don't have to deal with aliens invading or, you know, demons attacking them or superheroes or things. But, you know, Americans generally hate that sort of thing. So, you know, the American film industry is terrible at delivering realistic films, but they've gotten better at dealing with certain aspects of life that are realistic. I guess that would be my qualifier.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, we mentioned soap operas very briefly, though. I mean, isn't that kind of along the lines of what soap operas are, as opposed to something like a superhero film?
Well, they're not genre, you know. In other words, there's no supernatural elements to them. They're not realistic at all. They're, you know, they're ridiculously melodramatic. Like, you know, they have long-lost twins and, you know, people coming back from the dead and, you know, all just these ridiculous situations. And the people in them are all beautiful and, you know, they generally have very successful and glamorous careers and things. They're not realistic at all. They're possible, but they're not realistic.
One of the things that I'm fascinated by is comedy in terms of what we find funny, how it's changed over time. And if you look at, for instance, you know, if you look at comedies from, you know, if you go all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century, you have something like The Three Stooges, slapstick. It's kind of hard to imagine something like that being successful today. And if you look at, say, stand-up acts, you look at people like Bob Hope, you know, from the 40s and 50s. And obviously, then you have someone like Louis C.K., for instance, or, you know, or Dave Chappelle. And compared to today's stand-up acts, the ones of the mid-20th century seem incredibly hokey. So I guess, how do you sort of look at that through the lens of this question about cultural sophistication?
I think that there's some truth to that, but we like to tell ourselves that we're a lot more sophisticated than we really are, and we also, by extension, like to tell ourselves that, you know, the previous generations were less sophisticated than they really were. There's really always been a line between the masses of people who like kind of dumb, lowest common denominator comedy and, you know, people who like more so-called sophisticated stuff. But, you know, even Shakespeare knew it. You know, Shakespeare had the stuff for the groundlings and he had the stuff for the literate people, you know. But we aren't, you know, the people of the past were not quite as dumb as we like to think they were. I mean, sure, they loved the Three Stooges. They loved a lot of slapstick. They loved stuff like that. But, you know, for instance, the Marx Brothers were hugely popular. And their stuff is incredibly sophisticated. You know, some of Groucho's wordplay and, you know, some of the, you know, the breaking of the fourth wall that they did is extremely modern seeming, even today. You also had, you know, speaking even specifically of Bob Hope, you know, his stand-up act and the stuff that he did on television was all pretty hokey, you know. It was pretty stultified by the, you know, by the 60s and 70s. He was sort of a symbol of cornball comedy. But in the 40s, he did this series of films called, they're usually called the Road Pictures with Bing Crosby. And the writers had a lot of fun with those because they, you know, again, they broke the fourth wall. There was a lot of, you know, the referential stuff, the, you know, what we would call sort of meta-comedy, you know, today in those movies. And they were made, you know, 70, 80 years ago. So there's always been that element of comedy. Its popularity has waned and returned over the years. I would also say that we are absolutely not beyond farce and slapstick and stuff. Maybe we are in television. I think television comedy and stand-up comedy has generally become more sophisticated. But look at the movies that are really popular in terms of comedy, like Bridesmaids, like the Farrelly Brothers, tons of slapstick, lots of physical comedy, you know, lots of bodily function jokes. That stuff is still huge. So, you know, it's still making money hand over fist. You know, we've become sophisticated in certain areas, but in other areas, you know, there's people who know what they like, and what they like is seeing a guy get hit in the nuts with a football. So,
well, in an email, you know, beforehand, I mentioned the Jackass, you know, the MTV show that spawned films as well, too. And it's pretty much all slapstick. Is there a reason that you kind of see that more in film than you do in television?
Television, I think, has followed the model of music in a lot of ways. It's become very balkanized. You know, television, there used to only be three networks, and now there's 3,000 networks. So you can go, and you can also watch television any way you want. You can watch it on the computer. You have instant services, you know, where you can dial it up and everything. And you can do that with movies also, but movies are still pretty monolithic. You know, there's only a couple hundred produced every year. Most of them come from the big studios. Independent film has a lot harder chance of making it than independent television because, you know, there's just so much infrastructure and so much money involved in it. So I think movies
cater to the popular tastes a lot more than television does, because there's a lot more chance for a show to succeed on television with low numbers than there is for a movie to succeed with low box office. So I think that's one of the reasons why movie studios have become very risk averse. They very rarely make a movie that they don't think is guaranteed to make a lot of money. That's why you see these big slapstick farces. That's why you see sequels. That's why you see big genre films, because that's what people want to see right now. Whereas in television, you know, you've got a show like, Mad Men, again, to return to Mad Men, it's a good example because its ratings have never been huge, but it's very popular. You know, it's popular enough in terms of television, and it generates a huge amount of buzz that it justifies the amount of money that they take to make it. And so, you know, on television where there's, I mean, how many shows are there playing at any given time? There's probably 10,000 television programs on the air, whereas there are not 10,000 movies made in 10 years, you know. So just because of the economy of scale, I think television can take more chances, and movies cannot. You know, movies have to movie studios have to be a lot more sure that their product is going to sell.
What do you think of cultural tastes in America versus the rest of the globe? I mean, that's something you kind of hinted at a little bit earlier when you're talking about, say, European films. And, it, you know, looking at the American big-budget action epic, the superhero films, the genre films, the ones that are that tend to do best overseas are the ones that are full of explosions and have little dialogue. Getting back to this issue of sophistication, whether there's a disparity between American audiences and those overseas?
I think there is to a certain degree. It's true that, you know, snobby types like me like to say that, you know, foreign audiences are more sophisticated because, you know, foreign films are, especially in Europe and in Asia, there's a lot more willingness by studios to take on risky projects. There's a lot more willingness for the government to step in and fund certain types of art than there is here. Audiences will watch a realistic film, you know, or a dramatic film, a film that's sort of quiet. But on the other hand, you know, in every foreign country you can name, the biggest movies are always American exports that are, you know, action films, science fiction, superhero films, you know, big box office blockbusters. So I think there's more general cultural sophistication, but, you know, the mass of people still like over there what the mass of people like over here, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, so you're really talking about comparing independent cinema over here with, you know, with foreign studios then, right?
Right, but in Europe and Asia especially, those films don't get made necessarily by independent studios. They get made by big studios, and they get wide releases, and they get decent funding. Whereas here, you know, they just sort of have to scrape by because the studios don't take a chance on things like that. And, you know, that's there are regional differences. You know, a lot of African cinema tends to be very action-oriented and, you know, more like Western cinema, whereas in India, you know, you've got India's cinema is a whole different creature than Western cinema. So,
well, sure, and well, you know, you had, of course, a million, you know, kung fu movies right in the '70s, right, coming out of, you know, the Hong Kong, right, and even Hong Kong crime cinema was its own genre for a while.
Yep. Yeah. So there are different, you know, there are a lot of regional variants, and you know, but I think generally foreign film studios are a little bit more willing to take a chance on something that isn't obviously, you know, blockbuster type material. You know, you still see countries going through an entire movement where, you know, what we call art films over here are big box office draws. You know, people actually go see them and they get decent amounts of funding, you know. I think you still have this admittedly arbitrary high culture, low culture, elite culture versus mass culture divide in every other country. I just don't think it's quite as stark in Europe and Asia as it is here. I think it's a lot more distinct and a lot more noticeable in American cinema than it is in a lot of foreign cinema.
Yeah, something you said earlier is that, you know, this, it's sort of cliche to think that, oh yes, today's audiences are much more intelligent and sophisticated than they were in the past, or that the work being produced back then was inferior to the work being produced today. And if you look at music, it seems like you have the opposite that always happens. It's that you have it's the, always the older generation saying, well, the music that's being produced by younger people is low class and not nearly as good as the stuff that we listen to. Why do you have that sort of disconnect there?
Yeah, every generation looks at the music of the past and says, you know, that was the good stuff, you know, whereas the stuff you kids listen to today is just racket, you know, whereas, yeah, we're trained more to think of modern cinema and modern television as being a lot better. That's hard to explain. And I would say that part of it is probably because music of all the art forms is the most emotional. You know, music is the one that is least, there's no narrative, you know, it's not a narrative art form. And it's not necessarily an art form that depends on production values. You know, you can listen to a recording from the 1960s and it sounds just as good as one today. Whereas if you look at a movie made in the 1930s, there are obviously, you know, a lot of, you know, there's a lot of technical sophistication that has gone into filmmaking today. But it's also a very emotional art form. It hits you in the heart instead of the mind. And so people tend to formulate emotional attachments to the music of their youth that they don't necessarily do to film or television or literature or whatever. It's an old joke that, you know, music achieved perfection your sophomore year of college. You know, it's whatever year you were in college, the second year, that's when music was its greatest, because that's when people tend to get really into music, you know. And so I don't think that fully explains it, but it's really all I've got, you know, is that people perceive music and intake music in a more emotional way than they do other narrative forms of art.
Well, I think, just to add to what you said, people making television and film, how old are they? They're not 20 years old or right. 25 years old. I mean, they're people who are older. They're just usually filmmakers are just starting their careers in their 30s. You know, and most of them are in their 40s and 50s.
Yeah, the people on screen are young, but the people behind the camera have been working at it for decades. You know, whereas
teenagers, in the meantime. Yeah, well, I think people do have a natural resistance to listening to music made by people younger than they are, I for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, one thing I've talked about in terms of being a freelance writer is that the older I get, like I still like to stay very current about music, and I listen to modern music. I don't reject, you know, whatever young people are listening to. I try and give it a shot and, you know, enjoy it on its own terms, and I still get assigned to interview young musicians, you know, but I increasingly, the older I get, I feel ridiculous about it. You know, like if I'm interviewing a filmmaker who's 45 years old, you know, and has been working in the film profession for 20 years, I feel like I'm talking to him as a peer. Whereas if I'm talking to some, you know, 22 year old bass player in a metal band, I'm like, this guy thinks I'm an idiot, you know. Can I possibly say to this kid, you know, even if I like his music, he's like, what's your story, old man? You know, so it's, I mean, you know, pop music is definitely a young person's game. And, you know, I think that that doesn't necessarily mean that older people can't appreciate it. It's just, you know, it's more than any art form. It's keyed into your age and your attitudes.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, we talk about television and film and narrative storytelling sort of building on what's been done in the past. Obviously, I'm sure there's some of that with music, but maybe it's not as nearly as much.
Well, there's also the fact that music is, even when it's recorded, you know, that you can appreciate the sound of the music when it's been recorded in some medium or another. It's also a very, you know, it's very tied in with live performance. So, like, you can watch a movie from the 1950s and you can say, oh, you know, anybody of any age could appreciate this, even though it's old, because it stays the same. You know, it's the exact same thing. You can show a guy, you can show a 20-year-old film student Psycho or Vertigo. You can have a 20-year-old literary student read Shakespeare or James Joyce or whatever. And he's going to experience them in a very direct way, the way that you did when you first read it, regardless of the fact that everyone involved in creating it is dead. But while you can play somebody a record, like let's say you play somebody a Rolling Stones record, he might appreciate the music on its own terms, but he's going to think about the band, you know, and they're all guys in their 70s. You know, he may not want to go see them live, you know, just because he associates them with, you know, these relics who are still playing on stage, you know, that You know, there's just that live component makes a difference that it doesn't make in film or television or literature or whatever.
Well, how does that translate to something like classical music, though? I mean, here you have, you know, songs that have been composed hundreds of years ago, and no one who's written these songs is around to perform them.
Right. Well, that gets back into the high culture and low culture divide, is that, you know, that's one of the essential points about classical music being so associated with high culture, is that it was written by people who did not perform it. It was performed by people who did not write it. And it was intended to be understood as the product of a very academic and rigorous form of composition. Whereas popular music is intrinsically associated with, like, the people who made it are supposed to be the people who play it. It's supposed to be written by a collective, you know, it's supposed to be performed live in front of people who are, and, you know, involved in the process instead of listened to passively like concert music. That's one of the reasons that it doesn't appeal so much to young people, is because it's not as immediate, it's not as emotional, it has a more intellectual tone to it. And, you know, its defenders will say that that's a good thing. You know, that's what makes it high culture. But detractors will say, well, that's what's making it lose its appeal. You know, that's why people don't care about concert music anymore, or compositional music, or whatever you want to call it, classical music. And, you know, they want that immediacy and that intimacy of that pop music has. You know, the idea that the people who made it are accessible to you and are, you know, media figures. And you can't really get that even when the composer's alive. You know, you can go see a performance of, say, Philip Glass, and it doesn't even matter if he's there or not. You know, he's not an integral part of the process.
You've been listening to Split Reel for the Chicago Independent Radio Project, for Chirp Radio here in Chicago. And today, my guest has been Leonard Pierce. Leonard is a cultural critic who has contributed to numerous publications around the country. He's also the author of a book called If You Like the Sopranos, about the history of crime, cinema, and television. He's got a new book of short humor, and the name of it is?
Moods from Marbletown.
Moods from Marbletown, and you can find that on his website, leonardpierce.com. And anything else that you're working on?
Nothing at the moment, but when new material comes out, it's always on my website. So,
all right. Again, that's leonardpierce.com. And thanks so much, Leonard. I really appreciated having you back here.
Anytime. Always a pleasure.